Hello and welcome to the first installment of a multidisciplinary podcast on artificial intelligence and gender trouble. My name is Dr. Nike Jung. I am an early career researcher at the Institute of Advanced Studies at the University of Warwick. This first installment is on artificial intelligence and gender trouble, specifically looked at through the film Ex Machina and the TV shows Westworld and Humans. We have recorded two sessions, one with experts from the field and one as a chat among film scholars.
I'm Dr. Matt Denny. I'm an associate fellow at the Department of Film and Television Studies at the University of Warwick.
And I'm Owen Weech, and I'm a senior teaching fellow also at the Department of Film and Television Studies at the University of Warwick. Ex Machina is about an employee at a search engine company, and he's called Caleb, and he wins a prize to go and spend some time with
Nathan, the recluse and eccentric CEO
of Blue Book, which is kind of a stand-in, I think, for a mix of Google and Facebook.
Nathan reveals to Caleb that he has built an AI named Ava, and that he wants Caleb to judge whether Ava is capable of thought and consciousness. He also wants to assess whether Caleb can relate to Ava despite knowing that she's artificial. And during his questions, Caleb grows really close to this flirtatious and very beautiful android. At the end of the film, Nathan says Ava has only pretended to like Caleb so he would help her escape. And this, he says, was the real test all along. So Ex Machina tackles really fundamental ethical questions about artificial intelligence, but the packaging is very strongly via gender dynamics, or not to say stereotypes. It follows quite clearly a heterosexual male cisgender fantasy where Ava always remains the other. According to the director, Alex Garland, Ava is, quote, not a woman, she's literally genderless. The things that would define gender in a man and a woman, she lacks them, except in external terms. I'm not even sure consciousness itself has a gender.
Well, that's very interesting in that while Garland is saying that, a lot of the characters in the film are very much saying the opposite. So Nathan, the CEO, is very much concerned with saying that consciousness can't have a gender. So he says actually completely the opposite thing that Garland is saying. There's really an emphasis in that movie on a bromance of sorts between the two,
yeah,
or straining toward the unnaturalness of those kind of very, very patriarchally inclined kind of male relationships that is very much shown to be a sham throughout. And yet there's still, especially Nathan does accord to it in the way he views consciousness.
It seems almost as if the film has its easy way out at one point when Nathan says, can you even have a consciousness without a gender? And at the same time, Nathan is so clearly unlikable.
Yeah.
Although I love the actor.
He's great. Well, and also, I mean, he's the way that Oscar Isaacs has changed his kind of his body shape, he's very bulky and his costuming accentuates that. And he's got such a kind of explicit beard and he's shaved his hair as well to accentuate his beard. There's very much he's introduced, I think, recovering from a hangover and lifting weights.
Yeah, he's very hipster.
He's very hipster and he's always calling him dude,
yeah,
in ways that seem very unnatural. So there's a performative masculinity there, of this kind of hipster masculinity that runs throughout his characterization. And you're quite right, he's very unlikable in a way that throws doubt upon that performance of gender, which I think informs and speaks interestingly to the way that Ava performs gender in ways that are much more conscious, I think, is the way that it's revealed at the end of the film than Nathan does.
I think one of the things that I would have liked to have seen more in the film is the acknowledgement that Caleb's gender performance is also a performance. You have Nathan and Ava, who are very clearly coded as performative from their introduction, but it's only kind of, you only gradually see the cracks in Caleb's kind of performance. I mean, I notice you have Nathan as, you know, the bro type,
yes,
masculinity, but then you also have that other, I think, key formulation of contemporary masculinity, which is the nice guy.
Yes, it's very much
Caleb. And so he believes that he's working out of all these purely kind of chivalrous motivations, but even that notion of chivalry itself is, if I'm nice, maybe I'll get sex, which Nathan is very good at kind of puncturing, then presents his position of at least I'm openly misogynistic as somehow morally superior.
There's a scene with Caleb where Ava asks him, are you nice? He has this weird moment of pausing. Why doesn't he just say, yeah?
Well, he doesn't know, I think. And what's really interesting is that in that sequence, because it's basically a lie detector test, right? She points out that he's lying in every other thing he says. And yet when he pauses at the moment where he actually has, it's a really wonderfully performed moment by Gleason, and he has kind of trouble with saying that he's a nice guy. And yet Ava lets him believe that he is a nice guy. I think that's very key to the way that she deploys that male, that masculine stereotype towards her own ends and exploits it.
She's aware of the role that he desires to perform, even if he isn't consciously aware that he's doing it. And so she allows him to fit that kind of, you know, I'm going to rescue the princess from the castle role. The film forces you to kind of go around her. And
the guys do not come off particularly well.
Mm.
Yeah, so at least Nathan's character is very consciously performing and Caleb's is a performance. How conscious he is of that.
Was to himself as well.
I think. I thought that has also this dimension of the stereotype of the tech guy and the, you know, that Nathan plays so clearly against the stereotype of the recluse coder who's really uncool and not fit and, you know.
Caleb is an older vision of the kind of person that works in that industry. And Nathan is closer to a more contemporary vision of the tech billionaire. You think of Bill Gates as a kind of Caleb figure.
It's almost a generational thing. Mm. Nathan is clearly coded as like a Google type. Like his company clearly is meant to evoke Google, right? He wrote the Blue Book, right? And I had a couple of associations with that. One is Big Blue, one of the first really smart computers IBM built. And the other association I had was the blue flower in Romanticism. You know, this searching for this elusive object.
Project Blue Book, which was a US government investigation into the existence of extraterrestrial intelligence. So it also has connotations of an intelligence that is not worldly and is not intelligible. And it also, I think, very interestingly and very ambiguously, through the second half of it, calls to attention Facebook. And I think it yokes those two things together in ways which speak to contemporary anxieties regarding digital privacy, which the narrative is also very, very concerned with exploiting and exploring.
And then the link that the film itself makes explicitly is the Wittgenstein link, that the Blue Books are the philosopher's notebooks. And so you're thinking in terms of language games and things like that, and the problems of other minds.
Let's build on what we just discussed about the men to discuss, who is Ava? Is Ava a girl? Is she the internet? Is she the prototype for humanity?
I think the second one, my gut response to that is that she's the internet.
She's the internet, yeah.
She is, and you know, her intelligence is based on algorithms caused through human searches. As a way, so she's modeled on human intelligence, but is instantly transcendent of it.
Or not on human intelligence necessarily.
Or the decisions that
input.
Human. Yes.
Maybe to work back to this idea of, is Ava a girl? And I think the choice of the word girl is really interesting because it's not the same as saying, you know, is Ava female? I think not that that's a neutral word in itself, but girl is a very particularly culturally loaded term.
Very much.
And I think in that respect, Ava is a girl because of the way that she is constructed by the male characters, in that Nathan and Caleb certainly perceive her as a girl, in the sense that, you know, Nathan has this very kind of abusive paternal relationship with her. Caleb sees her as an object to be rescued. And so there's this sense of both the female, the passive, and the juvenile that all come together within this sense of girl.
And also she's very much, in terms of that youth, this notion of, she's asked at one point how old she is, and she says one is a primary stage as opposed to a temporal span.
It could even be one as on as opposed to zero as off.
So the completion of that binary on a binary system, which is harder to understand as well.
the reason I read Ava as girl isn't just because that's what's being projected by Nathan and Caleb, but because that's what she's very consciously projecting to Caleb.
I think it would be interesting to also consider which bits of her are projected as female and which bits are clearly robotic.
Again, there's a two-tiered system in terms of the way she presents, in the first instance, how she presents herself to Caleb, and in the second instance, where she goes on to escape. And I think in the second instance, she's very much constructed as a woman as opposed to girl. I thought what was really interesting in the first instance, her costuming is very girlish, or I suppose has connotations of tweeness in a way that it heightens that there is a roboticism to it, but also mostly covers it.
It's also almost like a reverse striptease, because she's putting on clothes, and that is the seductive scene.
Yes.
Instead of undressing.
At the end, when Caleb has been locked out and Nathan has been killed, I think you see this really interesting moment where she walks into basically kind of a hall of mirrors, and she clothes herself in the skin, literally, of these outmoded models of these other robots that Nathan was building. And what's really interesting about that is it is the first time where we see her wholly naked in human terms, and she has longer hair. I think there's the hair that has, she's just shorter hair in this kind of girlish way you were talking about, Matt, and then we have the longer hair. What's really interesting in that second instance is the way it kind of subverts, if not the aesthetics, but the strategies of the male gaze. So the male gaze is defined by Mulvey, instigates that what we do is we share the gaze of male characters who are very much active. And yet what we have in that instance is we share the gaze of male characters who have very much been made passive through her machinations. I'm not saying that I think that this is necessarily a subversive film in regards to that, but I think the strategies it uses are very much engaged with the way that she is using her, as Mulvey put it, to be looked at-ness in order to gain agency.
The audience shares the perspective of the male characters. Considering that Ava remains unknowable to the audience, we cannot really be on her side.
But if she does not see herself as a woman or a girl or female, why does she put on clothes in the first place?
Well, I think it's an example of drag and of an exploitation of many of the gender norms that we have seen the men falling to already in their relationship with each other and the way they speak about women.
There was something that I found actually disagreeable, especially regarding this male gaze. I did not understand why she sort of sacrifices Kyoko.
Isn't that a very human understanding of relationship to other, he says in quotes, people?
Yeah. But she seems to be acting out of revenge, which is like a desire or an emotion. That's true. That seems quite human. She does not seem to go very smartly about it.
I've been thinking a lot about Kyoko for this podcast because I find her quite an intriguing character. And I wonder, that complete lack of kinship that Ava seems to show towards what we assume as viewers is a kind of a fellow creature, as far as she might have those definitions. I mean, I wonder if the violence of her attack compared to what she does to, I mean, the way that Nathan is dealt with, is perhaps suggestive of disgust. I wonder if she sees Kyoko as something that's almost like her, in terms of she's an earlier iteration of the AI, or perhaps, I mean, I wonder how distinct are their personalities and programming? Are they both Ava? And so there's this kind of uncanny doppelganger moment where you see yourself but not quite yourself. And I think that becomes particularly troubling when you take in account of kind of the way that race and classes intersects with the character of Kyoko. I think there are lots of troubling things there kind of throughout the film, some of which are meant to be troubling and some of which I think are kind of accidentally troubling.
If Ava is like the internet, then it makes sense that there's not the same sense of an individual, then it makes sense that she would quote-unquote sacrifice Kyoko. Yeah.
There's also a line earlier on, if I'm not mistaken, which is when they're trying to work out whether or not she has consciousness, whether or not she can pass the Turing test, they talk about, if you teach a computer to be really, really good at chess, does it know what chess is? And actually that kind of self-awareness and that ability to step outside the situation. Throughout the film, that doesn't really get answered about Ava. In terms of the competition and the pieces on a chessboard, there's a very meticulous aesthetic to the entire film in terms of where things are placed and walls and doors and windows and who's behind where. And I wonder if that moment where she sacrifices Kyoko, I wonder if that shows a still a very competitive existence within a chess game. It actually doesn't necessarily conclude that part of the answer. There's a question of who wins or loses that runs throughout, you know, most of the interactions in the film.
Yeah, she seems to be programmed to want to escape.
There's a line in Arrival, which is, if all you're ever given is a hammer, everything's a nail. Maybe one of the reasons it's so difficult to talk about Ava and her motivations is because she does remain this unknowable other throughout the film.
Which again conforms to a host of gendered ways of thinking, which the film on one level seems very critical of and yet completely subscribes to them in so other ways. It definitely, it others artificial intelligence, but does so in ways that also other the woman.
Yeah, that's what I thought as well. That it's still like, you know, qu'est-ce que veut la femme? And now it's like, well, what does the computer want? And yeah. It's kind of framed in the same way. And like you said, with the race bit, it's not clear how conscious the film is of doing that. It seems to me a really stupid test that Nathan designed, because if you go with the cliche, men would be notoriously simple to manipulate with sexuality. To take that as a test of artificial intelligence seems just stupid.
Well, I think the whole movie is so concerned with limitations of thinking outside of boxes, both aesthetically, but also in terms of gender norms. I think there's a complete stupidity running throughout that movie. I think that the movie others Ava and also shares an affinity with her intelligence in ways that are quite telling.
Well, I think that the whole film has a very playful attention to transparency and concealment. I mean, the whole kind of set is a play on that with its many kind of glass panels. And as you say, the kind of boxing that goes on, there's lots of wonderful kind of scenes in the film where you have several transparent layers of glass or whatever the material is that you then have reflections projected onto that you can partially see through. And so you've got something that's apparently transparent, but that's actually in some way obscuring. And then at the same time, you've got something that is a concealing layer, but it's one that you can see completely through. Yes. And I think that that's a play that's continued into the design of Ava and is actually a component of Nathan's test, in that he says it's one thing to not see, you know, the Turing test, Ava would pass because if you couldn't see her, you'd immediately assume she was human. But you have to see her and know that she's a machine. And that's if you start treating her as human, even with that knowledge, with that evidence constantly before you, then she's passed.
The visibility itself is part of the test, which I wonder if that speaks to the way that she's designed, the design of the robot in this film, which, and especially with Ava in particular, as opposed to all the other previous models, which were, you know, we only see them partially destroyed, but they are all completely skinned, should we say. Whereas that, also the aesthetic of Ava and her design, where her upper torso is occluded, her groin and her thighs are occluded, and yet other parts are visible, we can see the robotics within them. I wonder if that ties into that as well.
I think so. I think that's a very kind of deliberate design choice there, to have this play with transparency, that you're seeing her artificiality. It's being announced constantly, and it's a challenge as to whether you read her as purely artificial or her motives as authentic or not. And I think it's something that Ava the character plays with as well. In her dressing, it's a very kind of deliberate veiling. And I think also there's something about the fact that Ava isn't necessarily read as naked until she's worn clothes, until you kind of create that binary.
There is this really interesting shot. It's a long shot of her getting undressed after she's dressed, and she takes off, are they tights or are they stockings? It looks like a kind of 40s pulp.
And it's lit from behind, so the dress becomes transparent, and her body also becomes transparent as well. So she becomes almost, through the use of light in that scene, completely immaterial, and yet is just kind of this, the shape of a body acting.
And I guess this is also where you can draw the line or link to that being almost like a meta comment on the film being some sort of Turing test on the spectator, that you, even though you know it's a film, you know it's artificial, but you still get emotionally involved and let yourself more or less voluntarily be manipulated by it or drawn into it.
Yeah, very much so.
And it's also interesting, the bit about her body, because that seems to be a recurring theme or trope in science fiction films, that you have to think about, do you just get a voice, as with Hal or in Samantha her. In her... Which is also interesting because she then does get a body.
Yes, the scene with the surrogate in her, I think, is particularly interesting because here you have Samantha wanting a physical relationship and meeting a woman on the internet who's happy to facilitate physical relationships between the artificially intelligent operating systems and their human partners. And it's this wonderful instance of a human becoming themselves kind of mechanical and having no agency, being used as a prosthesis for a machine.
It's weird that the body is such a prominent... It's always an issue. Like in hers, this discussion that she wants a body or he wants her to have a body, and they go back and forth on this. And I mean, I guess that ties in again with the idea of, does intelligence not need a body? Can you really create artificial intelligence? Is thinking only something like problem solving, if as humans we relate to the world through our bodies as well?
I think any artificial intelligence that was embodied differently to a human, either because they're immaterial like Samantha, or apparently immaterial like Samantha, or if, say, they're a six-legged mining robot that happens to be artificially intelligent, would the being that shares common bodily traits with humans necessarily think like a human? And would the creation that doesn't look anything like a human necessarily not think like a human?
I completely agree, but the funny bit then is, if it doesn't think like a human, which seems likely, how do you test it then? How do you test that it's an intelligent... I mean, the film raises that as well at one point, I think, when Nathan says, how do you test a chess computer other than playing chess with it?
I mean, chess has a binary logic behind it, and its pieces, the black and the white. And I wonder if that could speak to the way that the film deals with gender and the binary of gendered performance, in the way that how can you deal outside of male and female? Being locked within that, with, you know, it's not chess, it's gender. And being locked within gender, how can you actually test something outside of gender?
So is there room in this film for transgender issues?
I think it's interesting to have that tension with the director, Alex Garland, very much insisting that Ava is somehow genderless. But then when being kind of informed of these debates surrounding embodied consciousness, that he acknowledges that other people would read his film differently. It's quite an interesting interview in that he has this moment of, oh, maybe it can be this other way. But I feel that perhaps films about artificial intelligence are perhaps particularly pertinent in relation to trans and genderqueer issues, because you can explore how something like Ava, to what extent she's bound by, I mean, I'm gendering her immediately, by gender concerns because of the body that her intelligence happens kind of by design to inhabit.
And it's not just her body, it's also her behavior. I mean, we can argue it's just the behavior she's programmed to use in order to manipulate Caleb, but it's very stereotypically femme fatale, female seduction behavior. I'm obviously also always saying she and her, but I also feel really uncomfortable when they refer to the robots as it and things, and also disconcerting somehow. And I think it's meant to be. You're meant to feel a bit upset about it.
Ford in Westworld is quite insistent that the hosts are treated as things.
Exactly.
I think that there's a scene where one of his technicians has draped a towel over one of the hosts that's being groomed or prepared or repaired or whatever kind of process is happening there. And Ford gets incredibly angry and says, it's a thing, it doesn't feel cold, it doesn't feel shame. And then he mutilates the host with a scalpel to show his complete unfeeling towards these objects. And I think you could perhaps argue that that doesn't show a kind of the neutral unfeelingness that one might demonstrate towards a typewriter. It's a real kind of uncanny response to something that it's critically important for him not to treat them as humans.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't seem neutral behavior. It seems meant to put them down, like on a lower peg, which maybe says more about how we treat anything that's not human. Why do you think mise-en-scène is so claustrophobic? Like, they're really as if on lockdown. Why do you think it is made that way? Because it seems to be quite a contrast to all this play with veils and glass, etc., that you were referring to.
I think there's a running theme throughout the movie that is very concerned with showing Nathan and Caleb outside in nature at certain points and how alien they look to it. It's a very natural space. There is some, you know, wonderful sequences of really astounding natural beauty that are so contrasted with that claustrophobia and this question of it being unnatural. I mean, he even says, like, this is not a home, it's a research facility or something. Yes, like, yeah. That. And then when there's that whole sequence where they're standing by a waterfall, or this notion of Caleb taking ages to climb up that rock.
So it's nature that seems fake in a way, almost like background nature.
It's made to be something that is
alien to them.
Alien to them in a way that's really interesting as well, because that's really confirmed when Ava finally escapes and is dressed completely inappropriately for the natural environment in a way that they were as well.
And she goes to the city.
She goes to the city, but she walks out into the middle of the woods wearing very kind of formal white dress.
Virginal.
I'm not sure I picked up on Caleb and Nathan looking out of place or at odds with nature. But now that you've said that, I think that's actually a very pertinent
point. Yeah, they're always kind of sitting around either having a beer or there's this sense of like they're, I mean, it's total glamping.
What throughout. Is glamping?
Glamping is glamorous camping.
Ooh. That, like that sounds where so there's like no,
there's no engagement with the natural world other than there's something to look at. You're kind of living in this luxury 5-star heated tent with television and a chef.
But which is exactly what they're doing, yes. I think.
Yeah, and it's, again, very much this performance of masculinity.
I think there's even a line, again, and I might be getting this wrong, where they say something like they're looking at the waterfall and it's like, it's quite something, isn't it? They don't actually have much vocabulary in terms of how to describe this amazing beauty. They describe at the beginning, it's like, how long till we get to the estate? We've been driving over for 2 hours. All this beautiful landscape that we see is estate. That's it.
But I mean, I think where Caleb and Nathan may lack the capacity to properly engage with the landscape, I think the film is kind of very fluent in kind of the language of the sublime, and I think there's a very deliberate engagement there in that you're being presented with these landscapes that are traditionally associated with the sublime, with romanticism, the sense that it's the human confronted by the unknowableness of nature.
The film has these very sublime images that are so beautiful in terms of their colours, especially those kind of the ochre and the grey of the rocks and the sky, in a way that ties into the kind of discussions around a computer, the difference between a computer and a human. If I remember correctly, being a computer, know about colour, know everything about colour, but has only lived in black and white.
It can think about colour, but crucially can't feel what it is to see blue.
Yes. And I think the film is very concerned with showing you a sublime aesthetic and making you feel it in a way that Ava is eventually able to feel it. But I don't think that actually, and it's coming actually maybe possibly back to this, you know, black and white of the chessboard, that Nathan and Caleb can't. Where she's eventually able to.
They're not awake, we could say. Like, yes. They might have the human capacity, but they haven't cleansed the doors of perception.
Yeah, he didn't bother to put in windows. Like, he says, oh, it's a research facility. He could have put in windows.
When he shows him his room, on the one end, you know, it's huge. There's a huge bed. But you see it and you're like, oh my God, it's like a cellar. He's really imprisoned there. Who's the prisoner? Who's the object that is dissected and observed?
Very much so.
Well, he refers to Caleb as the human component, which I think is a really telling choice of words. That's already reducing the human to a system or a part in a system.
Yes.
You know, that's very much... He says he wants to be friends with Caleb, but that's, again, that's all part of the program. You know, to Nathan, he's just a transistor.
And he doesn't believe in friendship as well, in terms of the way he speaks about why he feels that consciousness implicitly has a gender. For him, I think the only use value that people have for each other is attraction. For him, it's a heteronormative attraction, which I think highlights that performativity of the dude and let's get drunk. Yeah. You know, there's something there, I think.
And that's again when Nathan has, you know, plays with this trope of being the mad/genius creator of these things, who is completely overreaching and is playing God and really does not see his own limitations of what will then eventually happen. So, you know, he plays out the strategy in his head, but then he's outplayed first by Caleb and then by Ava.
Well, he says he gets that line wrong, right? Where he mishears or misremembers what...
I would say deliberately misremembers.
Yeah. But he says, oh, I'm God. And then, but actually, there's this notion of it's the history of gods, this question of who is the God.
That brings us back round to the sublime again as well, though. And so you have Caleb saying, we've moved out of the history of mankind into the history of gods, which, you know, which for Nathan means I am God. Yeah. And so you have the, you know, in the sublime sense, the creations of nature, the creations of God. And so they are this unknowable space created by something other that is unknowable. And then you have Ava, who is also kind of unknowable. And I wonder if this ties into, you know, we talk about AI in terms of transcendence. We use these wonderful kind of romantic, sublime, almost religious terms to describe AI.
That brings us again to the blue flower reference in the blue book, you know, the elusive search of the romantics for this blue flower. I also thought that was interesting, Nathan misunderstanding this line about the god, that he switches it from the history of gods, plural, to he's now the god.
Yeah.
Yes.
If perhaps Ava doesn't think of herself as an individual, like she is the one individual robot who gained sentience, but more like she's part, you know, if she is the internet or something.
She is consciousness as opposed to our consciousness.
Yeah, she is like, she has this more oceanic.
Well, they call it, it's not software, it's wetware, that oceanic thing. And also it's the blue. There's definitely this sense of oceanic throughout, I think, which would tie into this notion of the sublime nature.
A kind of technological sublime, I guess, as opposed to a
Well, because the film itself and the way it represents those natural landscapes is very precise. And, I mean, I'm pretty sure it was shot on digital. It's a very digital-looking film.
It has that coldness and preciseness.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if at certain points it used time-lapse photography, even to show the shadow of clouds moving across. There's this precision, that digital precision to show the nature. I think they're kind of interwoven.
And it also has this odd beginning, right? And this middle part where Caleb is testing whether he's not maybe a robot. You know, when the film begins and it has this weird light on him and it seems almost like he's...
It's like a kind of biometric scanning or something, I think, which perhaps hints at omnipresence of technology and surveillance that I think Nathan mentions later that he's hacked every phone microphone in order to kind of understand, you know, collecting data from his users in a quite a terrifying breach of privacy, but which, you know, technology companies are doing on smaller scales already.
Well, they're collecting it and selling it, and we agree.
But that again points to that omnipresence of technology in that it becomes non-optional. You know, do you want to engage in society as it is, then you must give away your privacy, which is terrifying. And yet, as you say, we all do this.
This discussion about frontiers is also really interesting in terms of Westworld, another show dealing with artificial intelligence, in terms of the ways that it shows us these inside, these interiors, which are very similar to Ex Machina in terms of having a preponderance of glass and secrecy in different levels, and also a deceptive visibility. There's lots of plays where people are having clandestine conversations in full view versus, for those of you who aren't aware, it's set in a theme park where people can go and interact with robots of cowboys in a Wild West scenario. It's, you know, those interiors are juxtaposed with these sublime wonders of John Fordian landscapes, which I think is quite interesting as well.
And in Westworld, the nature bit or the bit about the park is clearly coded as a fantasy.
Very much.
And not as, you know, that is the artificial, like the nature again is the artificial bit in a different way.
Because you've got the kind of big monument, Ayers Rock style monument valley thing that has the complex built into it and you can see its ceiling poking up over it.
And it again has very much this connotation with cinema. I mean, with cinema history, but also again, like with this meta comment the show seems to be making on itself and on the viewer watching it.
Well, in terms of comments that the show is making on itself, the show's very canny in the way it plays with wanting you to make certain expectations. It's kind of what you were talking about with Ex Machina and the way that it puts you through a certain Turing test. This willingness to be involved with characters whom you know are possessing of artificial intelligence, and how moved can you be by this? And also, what is going to happen? One of the things that's striking me with a lot of these narrative forms, both movies and television, is this emphasis on our guesswork and the mystery and the way that they're structured according to a mystery where what can we know, what can't we know, which is built actually into the narrative construction of these things just as much as their narrative content. Because Westworld is basically a guessing game, I think, more than a story.
Yeah, I mean, the point about hierarchies of knowledge and revelation and twist, I mean, that is something very typical in general, I guess, in science fiction. And that you start to wonder who is actually, who is the artificial intelligence, who's the robot.
It's a very common trope. I mean, we have it in Ex Machina, like you say, where he cuts himself to check that he has. But Westworld is very, there's a wonderful moment in the finale where one of the engineers finds out that, spoilers, Bernard is synthetic and starts looking at his own arms just to check. Yeah. And Tandy Newton tells him, it's fine, you're not one of us.
Yeah.
It actually reminded me of, in terms of thinking about this trope of am I a robot, it reminded me, we were watching an episode of The Twilight Zone called The Lateness of the Hour. That really struck me because it's all about a woman who lives with her parents in this kind of locked room. She never goes out. And they have artificial intelligence helpers, manservants, maids, chefs. And she's frustrated with her parents for not living full lives because everything is automated for them. And she ends up finding that actually she herself is synthetic. So it's a very early example of that trope. What I thought was really interesting in both Westworld, The Lateness of the Hour, this Twilight Zone episode, but also Humans, there's this real concern with fears as to what artificial labor will do and how we can live our lives according to that. So she has these wonderful lines, the daughter played by Inga Stevens, who says, like, you're letting these do all these jobs for you to the extent where you're turning my parents into jelly. And Humans is very concerned with, you know, the daughter in Humans is worried about what job will she be able to have because synthetics will take it over.
I also think what's interesting with Humans, if we can just stay on that for a moment, is it very clearly identifies certain groups of people that are most at threat from kind of having these synthetic helpers. And so you have, you know, the daughter's friend is worried that he will essentially be out of work because he sees himself as only capable of performing manual labor. And then the mother is very concerned that a robot would be a better mother than her. And so you very much have kind of a class commentary and a gender commentary there.
Also, the circle seems to be expanding. So at first it's manual labor and you have these protests which evoke all kinds of protests and other relations, but then it's the mom, then at one point it's also the policeman who seems to be replaced as a husband by, you know, a robot who can perform better, and, you know, and so the circle enlarges.
But this question of what is the performance and what is being done is really interesting, especially in Humans, in terms of, I was really struck by the mother ending up having a conversation with the synthetic character who is coming in and sees it as a threat to her in terms of her sexual relationship with her husband, and as we've said, her duties as a mother. What's really interesting is the anxiety that produces in terms of what function we can have if certain functions are used by others. So there's this great scene where she's talking to her and asking if she feels or whatnot, and then says, oh, look at me, I'm having philosophical conversations instead of making dinner. This idea of what do we do if everything is done for us is really interesting. Do we start talking about philosophy and consciousness itself? Are we going to have to become more interesting?
At the beginning, there are some episodes where they try to sell it like, oh, now you have all this time to paint and to enjoy things. But at the same time, I thought that's also interesting because that is something that is used often to test the robots if they have a liking for art. And
that tends to show how they want to move beyond the constrictions of the use value that for which they've been constructed.
In Rossum's Universal Robots, which is the play that first uses the term robots, there's a whole conversation that takes place about how the robots are very much designed to have no passions, to not enjoy art, to not paint or sing or enjoy music. They only have interest in working. They don't get hungry
so
or
they'll
anything.
They'll allow like us that. To have those interests.
Exactly, yes.
Okay. But then, yes, Humans is dealing with the anxieties of what happens when we're given the time to have those interests. Westworld is also really interesting in that the people who visit Westworld are very wealthy. They have leisure time. What do they do with their leisure time? So the character of William is very interesting, and he has all this time and all this money. What do they do? How do they fill that time?
Yeah, and also on that level, it could be interesting to talk about the role of money in the park in Westworld in general, because it's not only that the park is a business and you seem to have a fair amount of money in order to
I think they
enter.
Put a number on it at one point. It's thousands.
Okay.
It's a lot.
And also when the Thandi Newton character wakes up and forces Felix and the other engineers to help her, you could be wondering why are they helping her? And it seems to be because even though they're humans, they're not actually that much more powerful. They're also just, you know, in this hierarchy. And if they cannot switch her off because she's proprietary. She's not their thing that they can switch off. They're just allowed to like dawdle stuff with her.
Well, the show is very interested in limiting your knowledge. I don't think we ever see the outside world in Westworld. we only ever see emissaries from high up in the corporation. We spend lots of time with the lower tiers of the workforce in terms of the hierarchies, in terms of wages. There's Tessa Thompson's character, and we see Ford. You know, there are characters who are very high up, but then most of the time, like you say, we spend time with these.
And even Ford, like initially you think, oh, Ford is this super powerful character. Yeah. But even he is not. Like at one point, the whole thing becomes a system.
Well, but Charlotte comes in as well and throws off what you think you know about this hierarchy.
Yeah, it throws off what you know. But also, like at the end of the day, it seems like to emerge as you don't have this one evil person. If you take him out, like, you know, if you killed Hitler, then the whole thing would be fine. You know, instead it's like, well, then he's replaced by somebody else and you don't know what would happen then.
Which I guess is this question of, I mean, in terms of the doubt that these properties throw on what it means to be human, this notion that the structures that structure our existence, and say capitalism, I think, in Westworld is this one where, you know, there's a visible face of it, but actually there are so many other structures that are programming us, to use a robotic term, that aren't visible to us.
And also it becomes a question of who controls the algorithm or the controllers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's almost like, okay, there you've created now these super smart things and they're out of control, out of your control, because you're not in, like, nobody is really in control. Like, who's running the show?
Yeah, even though, you know, in the final episode, we find out that Tandy Newton's character, who is rebelling, has actually been programmed to rebel.
By Arnold, right?
By Arnold, yes.
I'm sorry for spoilers. But Arnold is dead.
Yes.
So you have this whole thing of, like, there's a vacuum of who's supposed to steer this. Like, you cannot pin it to a person. It becomes a system in its, it becomes the code.
A system that was introduced and is,
the code is
self-extrapolating.
Running itself.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a Baudrillardian move there, if you're thinking in terms of postmodernism. The idea that, I was going to say he saw the world as being generated from code, but I don't think that's quite right. It's more that in his kind of science fiction slash theory, he's proposing that we're moving towards reality as being generated by a code, and so it's self-generating, it's no longer tied to anything else, and so you don't have a source or a point of origin anymore. You only have kind of these effects self-generating themselves, which I think is interesting, with Westworld forcing you to think in terms of systems rather than individuals, and that these are systems that don't necessarily have this kind of heart or this core, that they're just self-perpetuating, self-managing. And yet, I think when we're trying to decide what is human, it's still very much tied to this, I guess, romantic idea of a expressive self, a kind of inner truth expressed outward through emotion or expression. Or
Westworld something. Is so concerned with that, with this its motif of the maze, and wanting to get to the center of the maze, and it's basically what we find there in terms of this romantic core.
Which I guess brings us back to the blue flower as well, this kind of search for the unfindable. Perhaps if Westworld is very much moving towards this sense of self-generating systems without a source, perhaps that's the technological move